unfortunately, the community that we serve is especially vulnerable through this period. A lot of essential workers live in our community. They also live in more crowded housing, so they have more difficulty isolating. And when one member of the family gets sick, it's often transmitted to other members of the family. We've also had an epidemic of poorly treated chronic illness in our community due to the lack of access to healthcare. So this is all combining in a classic public health crisis for our community.
Dr. Elaine Batchelor, the head of Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital in South L.A., she spoke with KCRW at the beginning of January, back when L.A. County was the epicenter of the U.S. COVID outbreak. In December and January alone, more than 9,000 people died of the disease here. And MLK Hospital was at the very center of the crisis. The hospital serves some of the county's poorest residents who live in the areas hardest hit by COVID and who are also more likely to die from it. During the worst days of the outbreak here, MLK was treating more COVID patients than much larger LA hospitals. New York Times correspondent Sherry Fink spent about a week inside MLK last month. And while she was there, roughly a quarter of all the COVID patients in the hospital were dying from the virus. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on a New Orleans hospital after Hurricane Katrina. She later turned that reporting into a book. It's called 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. Sherry Fink, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you.
Well, MLK is a really small hospital. It has only around 130 beds. So how many people were they treating when you were there?
I don't remember the exact census, but they had more COVID patients than they had licensed beds for many weeks. So that's not even including the non-COVID cases.
Wow. And so, yeah, we've heard all the stories of hospitals setting up triage areas in, you know, waiting rooms outside even. Is that what you were seeing, just patients put in every conceivable place?
Yeah, they have. It's a small hospital. It's a very nice hospital, brand new, built just a few years ago. But they weren't built for that many patients. And even in normal days, because they have a pretty small emergency department, they actually have a couple tents that they use for overflow. So there were patients in multiple tents. There were patients in the emergency room and then along the hallways waiting in many cases, you know, dozens of them who were waiting to have rooms on the wards and then also in the intensive care unit, which was full until they opened. They sort of took over a whole patient ward that's normally just for regular patients, and they made that into the ICU just so that they could fit more people in it.
Wow. And you wrote that during the peak of all this, they were treating more patients than hospitals 3 to 4 times their size.
Yes.
Why? Why weren't they able to send some of these patients to these other hospitals?
Well, at first they didn't even realize it. And then back in late December, the federal government started to release statistics by hospital, by facility. And that's when someone at MLK, who had just assumed that every hospital was slammed, did some calculations and realized that they had more patients per licensed bed than any other hospital in like a 15-mile radius. And that's when, you know, they realized that there were, in fact, some like much bigger hospitals that even just had fewer patients at baseline, like not even as a ratio, just fewer COVID patients and were, you know, many times bigger than MLK. When they tried to transfer patients or some patients, though, they ran into trouble. Other hospitals were saying, you know, we're overwhelmed too. We don't want to change our standard of care by taking more patients. And the CEO at one point started to try to basically shame some of these other hospitals that, you know, these were their patients to try to take them. And but the bigger picture here is that these patterns are not something new for MLK or for hospitals that are safety net hospitals. In fact, a lot of MLK's patients, in fact, only 4%, looking at it another way, only 4% of MLK hospitals' patients have commercial insurance. And that's what reimburses at a higher rate than public insurance, like especially Medi-Cal. So when they try to transfer patients on a normal day who need a higher level of care, they often get refused, and the care managers have a really hard time arranging for that. And they have concluded that a lot of times it is this issue of reimbursements. And that's why the CEO talks about a separate but unequal system of healthcare in this country. Well, when COVID came, it just magnified that.
Yeah, it's so tragic because also these bigger hospitals and wealthier hospitals, they have the technology, they have more machines, they have some of the better treatments that possibly could have saved some of these patients' lives, right?
Well, that is what some of the doctors felt. And not in maybe a typical case, but for some of the people who needed more specialized care, who might benefit from certain things that a community hospital doesn't have, that in those cases, it could make a difference. And on another level, there's just this idea that if you're really critically ill and you are kind of on a knife's edge, that it matters if there are staff who can really monitor you very closely. And so you can imagine in a surge situation that is harder to do. And so there's a history of research, not specifically on COVID, but on very complex respiratory failure, you know, breathing failure patients, that shows that hospitals that do that more have better outcomes. The tricky thing with that is that it also could have to do with the patient population. And so it might have to do with being less stretched or having access to more kind of specialty care. But it also could be that because of these pre-existing disparities, because the populations that access that care have had poor access to care for so long, they have more underlying health issues, more diabetes, more hypertension, mm-hmm. things that make them more susceptible to a severe form of COVID. So the increased rate of death, seeing like some of these very, very difficult statistics, 86%, the hospital said, of patients on ventilators not making it with COVID could be not because of the care, but also, or even more so, because the patients are just sicker and have not benefited from, you know, the kind of healthcare that could have helped them be healthier at a baseline.
Right. And also, they come in sicker oftentimes. They wait till they're really, really, really sick before they come to the hospital. And at one point, you profile two men who died. One of them, he basically made the decision not to go to the hospital because the ambulance worker said, oh, his oxygen level wasn't low enough and he'd have to wait for 10 to 12 hours in the ambulance bay before getting admitted. And so the family decided, well, let's just turn around and go home. And then what happened was he got a lot sicker at home.
That's right. Emilio Verhen, a 63-year-old father of four, who had spent the pandemic delivering medications and food to seniors as part of his job as a minibus driver. He was sick and his family was concerned, called the ambulance, and the EMTs, the paramedics, checked him and said what you just said, that it would be a very long wait at the hospital, and his oxygen at that point was within the normal range. And so at that time, yes, he stayed at home. The children tried to reach his doctor and nobody called them back for days. And then they tried to find one of those little finger oxygen saturation monitors, the ones we all know, the fingertip ones. Those were mm-hmm. all sold out at the time. And so they ordered one on Amazon. And when it finally arrived, his oxygen was way below normal. And he got to the hospital. He was quite sick. Now, I don't think that there's great research yet on whether that makes a huge difference in terms of if you get there late and you're so, so sick already, is it harder to save you at that point? But one thing we do know is that there is a treatment that is called monoclonal antibodies. And many people know that because President Trump was given that, even before it had emergency approval, which it now has. There are two brands that make it, and there is some evidence that if it's given early before someone needs to be hospitalized, that it can actually save hospitalizations and save lives. The problem is that many hospitals aren't offering it to any great extent, and that the public really doesn't know about it. And this is the kind of intervention that could help prevent you from getting really sick. So if people aren't even able to get through to their doctors, are being discouraged from going for care until they're really sick because the hospitals, you know, in a surge are so overwhelmed, then people are missing out on this type of therapy that could possibly save their lives. And that, to me, finding that out, that this treatment exists, but a lot of people in this neighborhood didn't know about it, you know, that's really hard.
Well, certainly it could have been used on many of the patients you saw in your week or so at MLK, because a lot of them, as you say, fit the criteria. They have these pre-existing conditions.
Absolutely. They would have qualified if they gotten a test, if they knew they were positive. And in one case, there was a patient I wrote about who had he'd gone to Dodger Stadium and had one of those curative tests, and it turned out as very likely a false negative. And he thought he was fine. He thought it was just a cold, but it was COVID. And so he never even had the chance to know about that. And this other patient we were just speaking about as well, there was a time period where both men had diabetes, had high blood pressure, qualified in terms of their risk factors as people who could be at high risk for a severe case of COVID. But they never had that chance to get that monoclonal antibody treatment. I will say that I spoke with a doctor on the Upper East Side of Manhattan who has just been fighting for every single patient in her practice who gets a positive diagnosis and has these risk factors. She's been finding places for them to get that that medication. This is a part that wasn't in the story, but it was really striking to me. She's a private practice doctor. She has patients who have commercial insurance, and what a difference between her fighting for. And I think she had estimated that she's just in her little private practice, 36 patients since late November, who she's gotten the drug for, and none of them have needed to be hospitalized. And, contrast that with these gentlemen, one of whom went to a public clinic for people who are low income. He's undocumented. He had only emergency Medicaid. And his wife tried and tried to get through to the doctor and was just told, we have a long waiting list. And she said they hung up the phone. And the other gentleman who we were talking about earlier, the 63-year-old, his family also couldn't get through to the doctor. So they never even had the chance to, have that doctor inform them or offer them that option. Whereas a doctor who I just happened to know in Manhattan, here she is, making sure that all of her patients get access to that who qualify.
Yeah. Wow, that's tragic. And I'm sure it's the same situation in wealthier parts here in Los Angeles as well, with doctors here who may have access to that and might be able to offer that to their patients. So both of the men that you profiled in your article, they both died, and they are part of a really large population here in Los Angeles of Latinos who are dying of COVID and facing the brunt of this disease. And, it was instructive and eye-opening to see their stories and to have them in your story illustrate the larger problem. I guess I'm wondering if you came away with any conclusion about how they illustrate what needs to change in the healthcare system. Seemed to me that when you say it's an issue of, when you said earlier that private healthcare insurance versus public healthcare insurance played a part in where they got treated and how they got treated, if you came away from this thinking that a single payer system would have alleviated some of these inequities.
Well, this isn't my conclusion, but I will say that the CEO of MLK Hospital has been beating that drum and speaking with lots of media about it in the context of COVID, because she feels very strongly that there needs to be a systemic change. You know, it's her point that there are these two different, you know, separate but unequal systems in this country for people who have private insurance and for people who don't, for people who are wealthy and who aren't, and that's making a real difference, not just with COVID, but all the time. And it's contributing to COVID because these are the same folks, because they have such a much higher level of complicating conditions, because they have difficulty accessing healthcare, and because of all the other factors we've been talking about, the essential jobs, living in more dense housing, for many reasons being at higher risk, that it's all showing us these structural issues, these problems that have existed for a long time, and where people have been talking for years about disparities in health outcomes because of these issues. So I think definitely, you know, many of the physicians who work at MLK Hospital, many of whom have chosen to work there because they want to provide, you know, the equal standard of care to patients in South LA who don't have commercial health insurance. And they feel, you know, a lot of them have chosen to work at this hospital out of a sense of mission, that everybody is entitled to that equal standard of, you know, the best possible healthcare, the best achievable health. And so that is definitely something that they wanted to take this opportunity to highlight.
You live in New York, so you saw the beginning of the pandemic up close.
I did.
Were you surprised to come out here 10 months later and see pretty much the same thing in terms of hospitals being overwhelmed with very sick people who were dying?
It was very, very disheartening. I've been in New York during the peak, then in Houston during the peak in July and August there. And then to come here, I was also in South Africa when this new variant took off there, and saw that health system being overwhelmed in Port Elizabeth, which is like the an area that is one of the poorest in that country and least advantaged and least access to healthcare. So it was really disheartening to see it felt so similar to every other surge where these disparities were magnified, where there were various, like, very, very different outcomes in different communities, different outcomes in different hospitals, in part because they were in these hard-hit communities and they were more stretched and getting sicker patients, and also not able to have all the resources. So yeah, it was, I don't know if it was surprising because it's become such a pattern, but it's deeply disheartening that that's still the case, and that the toll is just so, so great in terms of human life. And part of telling the stories of these two men is just how much their lives have meant to so many people. And it's like you think each individual, and I know probably everybody listening, all of us have been touched in a personal way now by this pandemic. But to really go deep and it's very, very disheartening. I'll just keep saying that word again and again. It's hard.
Sherry Fink, Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
Coming up, there have been at least 20 attacks on elderly Asian Americans in the Bay Area in the last few weeks. We'll find out more about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There has been a wave of attacks on elderly Asian Americans up in the Bay Area in the past few weeks. Some of the videos are just horrifying to watch. In one, an elderly Asian man sits at the base of an ATM, the back of his head bloodied after being attacked and robbed in San Leandro. In another, a suspect runs up to an 84-year-old man, originally from Thailand, who lives in San Francisco, and violently shoves him to the ground. And that victim died of his injuries. In Oakland's Chinatown, a 91-year-old man was approached from behind and sent flying to the pavement. Here's Oakland Police Chief Laron Armstrong on Monday.
Some in our community come specifically to Chinatown to target people. We know that. We know that they target our elderly. We also know that they come because they believe that our community won't report it to police.
Well, the Alameda County DA announced this week that she's creating a special unit to investigate crimes against Asian Americans, especially the elderly. We're going to talk about all this now with Dion Lim. She's a reporter for ABC 7 in San Francisco, and she's been closely following this story. Welcome to the program, Dion.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, how many attacks have there been in the last few weeks?
Ooh, honestly, my head is spinning because there are so many, I can hardly keep track. I'll give you this stat. The Oakland Chinatown Chamber of Commerce collected stories from merchants and customers over a two-week period. And the president of the organization told me at least 20 robberies or attacks have been caught on camera or anecdotally taken down. So that's just an example of 2 weeks. But unfortunately, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Unfortunately, many Asian Americans do not want to report the attack, whether it be because of cultural reasons, they are ashamed, or they don't want to cause a stink. They don't want to bring attention to something negative happening to them and their community. So unfortunately, while 20 plus incidents over a 2 week period sounds like a lot, that's really just a drop in the bucket.
Wow. And it's not just in Oakland, right? It's across the Bay.
Yeah, we are seeing it all over the Bay Area. In San Francisco, I've gotten videos from Nest cameras or people on the street just showing everyday attacks, random or sometimes targeted. It runs the gamut.
And are these attacks or are they robberies and attacks? Both?
Yeah, it's everything. We've seen random attacks where people are pushed to the ground senselessly. In Oakland's Chinatown, it was three senior citizens who were knocked to the ground, and I believe nothing was taken. But then in other cases, we're seeing surveillance video from inside stores where a suspect will come in, take someone's cash and run away and push someone over. So it really, it just depends. It's everything.
Wow. And any idea if this is connected to anti-Asian bias around COVID?
That's a great question. Last year, when COVID truly began, I covered a whole host of incidents that were certainly hate crime related, because it was people who were pushing others down. There was a woman who was dragged through the Stockton Tunnel in San Francisco, her purse stolen. Another incident where slurs were being used while someone was being attacked. Many saw an Asian American senior who was collecting cans as a way of making some extra money on the side. And he was belittled, he was called slurs, and he was assaulted on camera. And that was really the first incident that got me thinking, oh my goodness, this is COVID related, because we are at the same time being blamed for bringing coronavirus to the United States. So in those cases, I can certainly say they were COVID related, but this is something different. This is violence like I've never seen before.
Wow. So something different, meaning is it born out of a rising crime rate in the Bay Area and elsewhere? I don't know, kind of a frustration, a madness associated with the pandemic's lockdowns and economic distress? Or what are the prevailing hypotheses?
Yeah, I wish I had a definitive answer for you, but what I'm hearing on the street is a few different things. One, law enforcement tell me that They need more officers, not less, on the streets to protect their elders. I'm hearing from various agencies that budgets have been cut in the wake of a lot of this talk of police defunding. I'm also hearing that because of the Lunar New Year, traditionally, many Asian Americans are wearing jewelry. They are celebrating by carrying cash. They put it in red envelopes to give to children and family members. But a lot of them are very savvy, and a lot of them know better. It's COVID. So they're not celebrating. They're not going out to restaurants, giving jewelry out to others as gifts, anything like that. But yet the stereotype remains that this is a group of people who have these assets and are easy targets because oftentimes they're frail, as we've seen. I mean, come on, 91 years old, 85 years old. It's really sickening.
It really is. And it has caught the attention of some people here in Hollywood, and several actors are speaking out against it and even offering a reward. I think actors Daniel Wu and Daniel Dae Kim offered a $25,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of whoever attacked that 91-year-old man in Oakland that you mentioned. And here is Daniel Dae Kim, who's on MSNBC on Sunday, describing other assaults against Asian Americans around the country.
A 61-year-old Filipino man was attacked in New York and had his face slashed just last week. A woman in Minnesota in her 90s was slapped and knocked to the ground and then kicked repeatedly in the face. And these are ways in which it just makes our community fearful to interact, to be outside, and it actually silences the community.
Right. So you were saying that they were already reluctant to go to the police, and this just makes it worse?
It absolutely does. The problem also stands that law enforcement sometimes have their hands tied because many tell me that it is a small group in certain cases of known offenders that they've dealt with. But unfortunately, because of certain decisions, they are let back out on the streets. So there's a reluctance from victims sometimes because they say, oh, you know, the person who attacked me, nothing's going to be done. Let's just move on and not talk about it, not report it. But it's that reporting that gets it on the radar of others that makes it a bigger issue and gets people to pay attention. What I love about what Daniel Dae Kim and Daniel Wu are doing is that they're using their platforms to raise that awareness. They have told me that they're not activists because that's not the role they play. Daniel and I had a long conversation just the other day about how he had moved from Hong Kong a number of years ago back to the Bay Area and was shocked. He just couldn't sit there and do nothing. And while coronavirus has stopped shooting schedules for the time being, he's now just throwing his support, hoping that maybe his platform can get other people who may not realize this is happening in the Asian American community to pay attention and speak out.
Well, Dion, thank you. And thank you for your reporting.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on because the more people who talk about it, the more we can better make some change.
Absolutely. Dion Lim from ABC 7 in San Francisco. Software giant Salesforce says most of its workers will work from home post-pandemic. Plus, comedy writer Meryl Marco looks back and her new graphic memoir.
And I started visiting the hippocampus in my book to just ask, why did we black that out? And in my book, I make it a hippo at a campus.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The software giant Salesforce announced this week it's going to let its 54,000 employees work mostly from home, even after the pandemic. Salesforce has offices around the world. Its biggest is in San Francisco. It's the city's largest private employer with about 10,000 workers based there. It also occupies the city's largest building, Salesforce Tower. It's unclear if they're going to stay in it. Salesforce is just the latest Bay Area tech company to announce a permanent shift to remote work. Facebook, Twitter, Square, Dropbox, they've all announced plans to do the same. And that could have big ripple effects in the world's tech capital. Here to tell us more is Katie Bindley, personal tech reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, what exactly does Salesforce do?
They're like enterprise software, basically, for businesses.
Right. And so they're one of the biggest companies to do that in the world?
They've got 54,000 employees, so it's definitely a very large company. And basically what they shared with me is that pre-pandemic, 40% of their employees were on what they consider to be a flexible schedule, so coming into the office between 1 and 3 days a week. But they're planning on growing their staff by 12,000 people this year, so that'll bring them up to about 66,000 employees. And they're now upping the percentage of those that will be flexible, and it's going to be up to 65%. So you're looking at, you know, I think if I did my math right, almost 43,000 people not in the office full time anymore, which is a pretty substantial number.
That is. And so that would mean that they wouldn't need big office buildings like the one they have in San Francisco.
I mean, what they've shared with me is basically that they are, you know, still excited about San Francisco. They're still committed to San Francisco. They just feel like they can do more with less space, but they wouldn't specify, like, how much square footage they might be reducing by, but that they're going to be reconfiguring the spaces. And so the focus will be more on communal spaces and less, as they described it, you know, a sea of desks. But, I mean, if you figure, you know, your staff, 65% are coming in between 1 and 3 days a week, you're obviously not going to need the same volume of space as you would if, you know, if the former number were coming in, you know, that amount of time. So the theme was kind of, yes, we're going to be doing more with less, but they, you know, they wouldn't share exactly what that's going to look like from a square footage perspective. But basically that in, you know, in all the cities they're in, that, you know, that their real estate footprint will be a bit smaller.
Right. And they do have other smaller buildings in San Francisco. So perhaps they could hang on to those and have the flexible work schedule in those buildings, because I assume you're not going to have the 65% working 1 to 3 days a week in at the same time. Like they would be staggered.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be staggered. But they certainly didn't indicate that they're like no longer going to have anyone in the Salesforce Tower. That wasn't the impression that I got.
Right.
But, you know, these staggered schedules will certainly mean that, you know, you're just, the volume of people in the space is going to be less, and one would, you know, logic would follow that you're not going to need, you know, every piece of real estate that you had prior, every floor or whatever.
Right. Well, as I mentioned, other companies are doing the same, making work from home permanent in the Bay Area, like Facebook and Twitter. So what does that mean for the future of the Bay Area? What is it going to look like up there?
I mean, I actually reported a story back in August about sort of how tech workers were feeling about the shift to remote work and what it meant for their plans in terms of where they wanted to live. And the responses were really interesting. I mean, you certainly, you know, the city of San Francisco, rents have, they've been going down throughout the pandemic. I believe they rose for the first time in January in months and months and months. But even, I mean, I live in San Francisco and my landlord reduced my rent by $200 a month. And it's been that way for about 6 months now, because this is, you know, their inventory is up in a way that they haven't seen in a very long time. Now, but of course, there's the city and then there's the broader Bay Area. And I think, you know, in the story that I reported, what I found is that a lot of people who had been in the city are just like looking for more space. You know, working from home has made them realize, oh, wait, a 1 or 2 bedroom apartment, you know, with kids and a partner who is also working doesn't really work that well. So I think we've seen rents in the East Bay go up. Housing prices in Marin have gone up. So there's been this, you know, I think more of a sprawl going on. And then also I've talked to people who, you know, they decided to move to Sacramento where things are much more affordable. But if they need to go into the office once a month or once every few weeks, that's still an easy commute. So you've got sort of that cohort that's maybe just leaving the city. And then you've got another group of people who've decided, you know, the pandemic is a catalyst for them to finally move back to the place that they always thought they would eventually. So it's sort of accelerated plans that maybe they thought, you know, they weren't going to take a move or make a move until 5 years from now. So I've talked to people who are moving back to their hometowns. Maybe they've got family in North Carolina who can help them with childcare, or in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then you've got people where, you know, lifestyle, not just cost of living, but lifestyle has become something that they're much more focused on. So they want to be able to, you know, go skiing whenever they want. So they've moved to Park City, or maybe Austin has the kind of lifestyle they're looking for. And I think the pandemic has basically just broadened people's idea. Well, it's broadened their ability to be able to work from anywhere. And so what you see is, you know, both in San Francisco and New York, more people realizing that they don't have to be in these very expensive cities to do their jobs anymore, at least not full time.
Katie Bindley, personal tech reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the comedy writer Meryl Marco has a new memoir out, which she illustrated. It's an exploration of her childhood diaries. Our conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, you could say that Meryl Marco has a way with words, and that would not be an understatement. She co-created the show Late Night with David Letterman and was its first head writer. And you can thank her for Stupid Pet Tricks, Stupid Human Tricks, and Viewer Mail. Marco also wrote for Sex and the City and a lot of other shows. But before all of that, she wrote diaries, documenting her life from fourth grade all the way through college. She stumbled across those diaries a few years ago, and in a new graphic book, she recreates some of the entries, painful as they are to revisit, to explore how she became who she is now and why we all choose to remember or choose to forget certain things. The new book is called We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco, and welcome to Press Play.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So I'm picturing these diaries as having a little lock and key on them, one of those little girly diaries. Is that what what your diaries look like?
Well, the ones that I started out when I originally started to write this book, that's what they were. And it made me laugh. I found them at the bottom of a big box full of stuff I was saving, because I save a lot of stuff. And I was looking at the lock and a key, and I was thinking, what in the world was I ever writing when I was 10 or 11 years old that needed to be locked up and kept from the light of day? When my mother gave me my first diary, which was in fact one of these ones with a lock and a key, I had no idea what you do with it because it's all these blank pages with dates on it. So I just started writing down every single thing I did every day, which was suddenly this weird little window into an era. And in the voice of a kid, seemed to me it might be a funny thing to do to have that kid tell you what daily life was like in the 60s, because she wrote down everything.
So when you're reading those pages every single day, I imagine there was a lot of boring stuff in there, kind of like we had spaghetti for dinner type of thing, but also some really interesting insights. Did you like the girl you were rereading?
You know, I watched her turn into me as I read this stuff, because I was writing so much that little by little by little, she was getting a clue. But when she started writing those books, she really didn't have a clue. I mean, until I reread this stuff, I had no idea that from the ages of 11 to 12, I was in love with a Nazi. I mean, actual Nazi. All I remembered is how cute I thought he was. And I did remember that he used to do Heil Hitler when he saw me. But I somehow didn't put that together with, like, that he was Jew baiting me or anything. I thought it was, he's paying attention to me because he kind of likes me. Because I was sort of accustomed to that was the way boys paid attention to girls, is do something horrible to you to show they like you, kind of. So it didn't really occur to me until I was rereading these things and thinking, what was wrong with me that I wasn't deeply insulted by that? And that was when I started adding myself into the drawings I was doing. I started drawing myself into the drawings and just sitting down with the girl I used to be and going, what's the matter with you? What could you possibly be thinking? So she started getting a clue at about 13, would say.
It's interesting you're talking about yourself in the third person, like this is a totally different person until age 13.
Yeah. Well, you know, because I'm a writer, at some point when I started making her the center of a book, she became a her to me. You know, I mean, it wasn't me, it was her. And I started looking at her story arc, which of course is my story arc. And, you know, you don't actually, I don't know if this would be true for you, but I didn't really know what the story arc of my early life was until I started assembling this stuff. And then I realized that I was always headed into media. I didn't know that I was headed into anything. But I was obsessed with television and radio and movies like most kids, but I was interacting with them. I was entering contests to get a monkey to come to your house for your birthday, and I was entering radio contests, and I was calling in news stations to give an opinion, and I was doing a lot of interactive media stuff, and I was writing down the plot to every television show I watched, which is a hilarious thing to have a record of, you know, but I was taking it all very seriously.
There's also some really poignant stuff in here. I just want to point to one page early on where your entry is for Tuesday, June 14th, 1960, and you go to get a checkup with your doctor, and he makes an offhand remark that you say changed your life forever. But you blanked it out. You don't remember it, but it was in your diary.
Yeah, that's why the diaries got really interesting to me, and why I decided I would make it into a book, is I didn't remember that, but I went for a checkup and he told me I had to lose some weight. And that was the beginning of a whole lifetime of, like all the women I know, it isn't just me obsessively dieting, but that was the kickoff for me, you know, like 10 years old, this guy goes, why don't you take off some weight? And it's weird that I blacked it out, because it really was the beginning of calorie charts and carrying books around that said cookie, 4 million calories, egg, 80 calories, like you're not supposed to ever eat another cookie.
Right. And you end the book with you talking to your young self, basically saying, look, don't worry, in 50 years, there'll be a body positivity movement. So, and she says, I have to wait 50 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, it finally came around, but it was kind of a little late. Well, it is kind of amazing that something did actually resolve a little bit, although I'm not sure what kind of impact it's having on the 13-year-olds right now, probably not as much as it's having on the 58-year-olds.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the other thing that you unearth in these diaries is the presence of your mother and the conflicting feelings you have of your mother. And you write that you had all these memories of her, negative memories, but then in your diaries, you realize that she was perhaps a more nuanced, complicated person than you remembered her to be.
I'm sure she was, but it's funny. I started, as I was recording this and turning it into a book, I started examining memory, because it's a very unreliable thing, memory. And and like, even when I was reading my own diaries and doing drawings of them, I would, when I got to a page like that page with the doctor that you just mentioned that I didn't remember at all, I had an image when I read it that created me at the doctor, but now that seems like a memory to me, and it's really an image I made reading my recordings in the diary, and I don't know if it is a memory. So it gets really weird. I started examining all that kind of stuff too. My mother, what I'm left with, my mother is gone. What I'm left with is she was a very, very angry person who never explained to me why she was angry. So I never could get to the bottom of it. And I sort of have created reasons why I think it was. I think it had to do with the fact that she wanted a job and didn't really mean to just be a housewife, but created that and trapped herself by it and just was angry for it. But so what I'm left with is, now that my mother is gone, is mostly memories of her yelling at me and criticizing me. And when I was reading these diaries, I was realizing that there were many other days where she wasn't yelling at me and being angry. And those were the ones where I wondered, so what was going on there? You know, like, it's, she left a legacy. I'm not sure she wanted to leave. I don't think she knew she was leaving a legacy of just rage. But I have to say, that's the legacy she left me with. When she died, it was the absence of fights, kind of, which is a terrible thing to say, but it's the truth. And so I was looking at all the other days that where I would record anything about her and think, well, no, that was, I guess this was a nice day with her, you know? But that's not the stuff I remember. And that's the thing about memory. You remember what you remember. And that's another thing that I've started doing in this book is I started looking into, well, how do we make memories? And memories are stored in a place called the hippocampus, which is a little area where long-term memories are. And I started visiting the hippocampus in my book to just ask, why did we black that out? And in my book, I make it a hippo at a campus because that's a joke that's just sitting there waiting for me to make. So I couldn't believe no one had made that one before. But anyway.
And you draw the hippo, and the hippo is quite friendly looking, although I know in real life they're not. But this hippo seems pretty
vicious,
friendly.
But,
was she finally proud of you when you were an adult and working on the Letterman show?
You know, it's funny. I have made a sort of a study of mothers because of my old mother difficulties once I went into therapy. And all the women I know, and this is, I think, true of men, too, but I mostly studied of women. All the women I know who are funny for a living or compulsively funny had this one mother. These mothers created all the comedy in the world. And I'm told that she said nice things behind my back. So I think she was, in fact, proud of me, but not to my face.
I'm also interested in the artist side of you because I didn't know that you were such an accomplished artist. And I just knew of you as a writer. And this is a graphic memoir. So on every page are your wonderful drawings. And you taught art at USC. So I guess I'm wondering how you pivoted to the writing part, because it is a totally different part of the brain.
It is. You know, I think they made a mistake putting writing on the wrong side of the brain, because the fun arts, music and art, are on the right side of the brain. And writing is with math and like organizational charts and stuff. I think that was just an oversight somehow. Writing means to be on the other side of the brain, but that's why you hear writers complaining about writing, but you rarely hear musicians complaining about playing guitar. You know, just, I got to go play guitar again. But writers never stop complaining.
That's true.
But the way I pivoted was I got this job teaching art at USC, and all my students were going into some form of show business. And it never occurred to me that it was a job you could get. When I realized there was a big film department at USC, I started auditing classes because I could, because I was faculty. So I took script writing and I took filmmaking and I took all this stuff. And then within a year, I wrote a bunch of spec material and I got jobs. So I shocked myself completely by, as it turned out, being hireable, more hireable as a writer than I was as an art teacher. So I switched.
Huh. Do you still keep a diary?
Yeah. Well, I haven't been late, not through quarantine. I started doing cartoons about quarantine instead of keeping a diary because it hasn't really been that interesting. You know, that was another thing that was interesting is, when I kept these diaries when I was a kid, I was really writing everything that happened to me. When I started to become older, like in my 20s, like a lot of women do, it became a place to vent. And so they were way less interesting when I hit my 20s than they were when I was a kid. The fact that I was writing down what movie I'd seen and what the plot of it was way more interesting to me than when I was 27 and I'm going, and then you know what he said, and then I said, and then he said, and then I said. You just go, shut up. Not as interesting.
That is so true, right? The sort of boring histrionics of youth. Yeah.
Yeah. And then bad romance, you know, beat by beat by beat. And he said he was going to call him, and it's 4 hours later, and I'm sitting here waiting. That stuff, jeez.
Maybe that'll be in your sequel to this book.
Does anybody want to read that stuff by somebody else? Everybody's got a version of that.
Oh, my gosh. Well, at the end of this, how would you describe yourself as a girl when you look back on everything and you're looking at all of these diaries? Like, if you say, this is who I was as a kid, what would be the line?
I think she was a really sort of an average kid until I started going into the arts and started seeing myself as creative. I was just a kid trying to find her way. And that's the person who wrote these diaries, is a kid looking for a boyfriend and watching TV and watching the world be scary. And I was thinking that maybe this would be a point of encouragement for some 15-year-old girl if she happened to read it, where she would go, well, she thought she was a reject, and I don't know who she is or what she did, but she at least wrote a book.
And illustrated it, too.
Yeah. So, like, apparently life went on without a boyfriend at 11 or whenever I was throwing in the towel because I was such a reject. That's the drama was so big for those years, too. I mean, I'm guessing it still is.
Well, Meryl, it has been so much fun speaking with you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and fun speaking with you also.
That's comedian and author Meryl Marco. Her new graphic memoir is called We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. All right, that does it for us today here on Press Play. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast whenever you want. You can listen over and over again. KCRW.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.